Welcome to the St. Martin's Challenge podcast, where we give a voice to the most vulnerable in our society, hosted by me, Lewis Owens.
And me, Savraj Kaur.
So, hi, Sav.
Hello, hi.
Very poignant episode today, as we're joined by Richard Ratcliffe, husband of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who has been detained in Iran since April 2016. And Anna Diamond, who was herself detained in Iran for 8 months. A very warm welcome to you both. Thanks ever so much for coming on.
Thanks for having us on.
Pleasure. Now, Richard, I'll start with you, if I may. Now, Nazanin's case has had quite a lot of coverage, but for those who perhaps aren't familiar with the background, she was sentenced in September 2016 to 5 years imprisonment, charged with aiming to overthrow the Iranian government. She's now currently under house arrest and is due for release in a matter of weeks. Firstly, and most importantly, how is she?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. She's obviously waiting a bit anxiously as we stand. So as you say, she was taken 5 years ago. We've had a long process of time in solitary confinement, then time in regular prison. And now since almost a year, she's been under house arrest at mum's and dad's with an ankle tag on. So she can't go more than 300 metres, but she's not in prison. And her sentence comes to an end in just over 4 weeks. So at this point, there's probably just a basic anxiety as to whether she's going to be allowed to go at the end or going to be kept for longer. And probably as we get closer, we get more stressed, I think, and more worried as to what will happen. But at the moment, you know, it's still possible. So part of my job in all interviews I do at the moment is to keep my fingers crossed and to keep hopeful and you know, to let everyone keep wishing and praying and maybe it will happen.
Absolutely. How often do you speak with her, Richard?
Yeah, no, well, because she's at her mum's and dad's much more frequently. When she was in prison, so at the very beginning, almost no phone calls at all. It would be once a month with an interrogator standing next to her for a couple of minutes, her terrified. Normal prison, there was a rota, and it would be a couple of times a week for a few minutes. And now she's at her mum's and dad's, so on Skype, I can talk to her as and when. So probably when she first came out, we were speaking absolutely loads, and particularly speaking to Gabriella, our daughter, who'd been in Iran when she was taken, was there for 3 years, then came back to live with us in with me in London. And obviously her poor mum missed her when she wasn't able to visit in prison and so on. So her being under house arrest has at least allowed her to be able to sort of see Gabriella on a call like this, where you can see the person's face. So probably every day, morning, evenings, couple of phone calls. You know, of course, small children, if there's a good TV programme on, a bit harder to come to the phone, and all the sort of huge stuff we all face as parents. But we've had for us, lockdown has coincided with Nazanin coming out on furlough, which has meant that in some ways lockdown for us was very good at the beginning, because it just was a time, not quite all together, but all together virtually. And probably at the beginning of that process, we were all very hopeful. As it went on and dragged on and became less of a novelty, it was tough, and we all have different ways of coping that got taken away by lockdown. So now, yeah, she can be sometimes very low, whether it's to do with what's going to happen next or just the fact that, yeah, life is going on and she's stuck there, and there is this game of chess going on between two countries that we're, you know, we're a chess piece in the middle of.
Sure.
I'd love to know a bit more about Nazanin, how she is, her character. We know from following the news, she's very well loved as a daughter, wife, mother. And there seems to be little shared about how she is as a person. I'd love to know if you could tell us a bit more about that.
She always, I was interested to think about, because she always maintains that she's changed a lot in prison. And I think there is something about just having been exposed to quite different experiences. But certainly to go back 5 years to Nazanin and I first met, 10 years to Nazanin and I first met. Yeah, loving, kind, quite playful, quite, you know, when we met, she had just come to Britain. So it was kind of the first time she'd been outside of Iran, apart from on sort of very quick work trips. And it was just lovely to see the world through those enthusiastic new eyes and you know, going around being jaded about the rain, and suddenly just how pleased she was that, you know, she didn't get told what to wear and so on. And, you know, she's quite particular. So things like her hobbies, she likes dressmaking, making clothes. She quite likes calligraphy. So the things that are quite precise that I don't have the patience for. She's quite exacting. So in that sense, I think prison was quite hard at the beginning because it's not a clean environment. It's certainly not a clean environment. And she's got a pretty strong sense of right and wrong, if that makes sense. So certainly was just outraged at the beginning how unfair it was. And certainly, yeah, you know, back in normal times, there were a few times when she pulled her husband up short for things he wasn't doing and so on. But yeah,
she's a charity worker as well. So she sort of spent a lot of years working on projects to relieve people of their own problems. And now she's found herself in the middle of this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we were not political at all. She was certainly not political. So she had gone into charity work through, there was a big earthquake. So she started off as an English teacher. There was a big earthquake in Iran, a BAM earthquake, about almost 20 years ago now. And she'd gone as a translator, and from there, you started working with the Red Cross and the World Health Organization. And so, you know, it ended up doing a bit with the BBC and then with Thomson Reuters Foundation, which is where she was working in her most recent job. But I think she was always quite careful to avoid politics, if that makes sense, in the sense that if you grow up in Iran, politics can be quite dangerous, and you all learn where the red lines are. So definitely keen to make the world a better place, but not in ways that were not allowed by the government.
Right.
And I think then, you know, comes out now a lot more political because she's been, you know, horribly mistreated. And you know, yeah, we've clearly been in the middle of this big fight. So, and of course, in prison, she met a number of amazing human rights activists and women and religious minority women and, you know, some people who in normal life she would never have come across, who opened her eyes to a lot. You know, none of us ever know what we don't know until we're put into a situation where you suddenly meet, you know, how the world looks from different shoes. And so I think that experience, when she says it's a change, literally having to cook for 20 people, which she didn't have to do before, but also just being exposed to you know, quite what some people have endured.
Sure. Well, Richard, before we bring Anna in, you've been quite vocal in the media recently, and it seems you've been advised not to speak too much about her pending release. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
About the decision then to go and say that in the media. So we have been advised the past 5 years to keep quiet. So that's not a change. And probably
by whom, Richard?
So we've been advised, probably by everyone, but by the British government specifically. So the Iranian authorities don't talk to me at all. I would regularly be talking to the British government and saying to the British government privately and in the public domain, you need to do more to get Nazneen home. This is your responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. And at the beginning, we got told to keep quiet, and we were quiet for a bit. And gradually, over time, we've become more estranged, probably more vocal, more critical of the government's performance. And of course, it's gone on so long. And then recently, so last week, in fact, very recently, the most recent attempt at the Foreign Office were quite keen for me to go quiet and just said, listen, we've got intelligence that there are threats and that there will be things happening to Nazneen and to her family if you continue to publicise her release date. And I reacted so badly, partly because we just get told to keep quiet all the time. But I genuinely believe that transparency is the best way to protect yourself from abuse. It's a really abusive context, which we partly understand and partly don't. It's big politics that goes on around us. We don't know what we don't know, and we never will do. But the idea that you protect people by keeping victims quiet is never true in any sphere of abuse that I can think of. And I've always not been tactical about that. Like, we don't try and think when's a sensible time to talk or when it's not. We're just consistent, and that's to stop people playing games with us. So I was really strung with the British government, with the Foreign Office, when they said it, like initially, and then having slept in for a day, and then I did put it out in the media because the Iranian regime is very manipulative. It's very manipulative of families, of victims, and of just putting pressure and squeezing people. And the way, one of the ways in which you don't get played is by just being very straightforward and very, you know, so if we know something, we put it out there. And since I've done that, there have been less threats to my in-laws. You know, that doesn't mean to say that people don't feed us things wanting us to say it. A different problem, but the basics of people threatening to put, you know, other family members in prison or dispossession of their homes, all the things that happen behind closed doors to other families, don't happen as much to us because it'll end up in a newspaper.
Sure. Let's bring Anna Diamond in. Hi, Anna. Now, you had your own experience of being hostage in Iran. You were arrested in January 2016 at the age of 19, and I believe you were accused of spying for MI6, and you were the youngest female inmate at Evin prison. Did you feel that you received sufficient support from the British government when you were held, and do you think the government could be doing more for Nazanin?
Well, hello. First of all, thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure.
So this is a bit of a tricky situation. So at the time, I held a Finnish passport, which is different from the British, obviously, but I was a permanent resident in the UK. And so in that regard, the UK didn't have the responsibility to help. But equally, the Finnish government also said that they cannot help because I was a dual national and Iran didn't recognize dual nationality. And so I definitely felt like I was arrested because of my British residence and, you know, my settled status here, because time and time again, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards said that the Finnish passport was a cover-up. And that it was part of the MI6 plan to divert attention. And so it was quite complicated to understand at first, but obviously hindsight is everything. So, but I remember when I was released on bail in August 2016, and I was under house arrest, very much like Nazanin, but around January and February, I was allowed to leave my house to meet my lawyer. And by this point, I had my hearing and I had met my lawyer literally 15 minutes before the hearing. And the lawyer had said that they need more time to assess the case, which the court at first didn't want to approve. And then afterwards, they just realized that the lawyer wouldn't have the necessary information to be able to defend me, which is ironic because, you know, as we now know, all these cases are predetermined. So it, you know, it's just part of the play. But I remember I took a huge risk and I called the Finnish embassy, which I wasn't supposed to do because I knew that all my calls and everything was monitored. And I called from my cousin's phone and I said, I need your urgent help, because at the time my dad was still under a death sentence. And by the way, context a bit for those that don't know about my case, my parents and I were all arrested together, but my mom was released after about 2 months, and then I was, and my dad was there up until 2018. But so I called the Finnish embassy and I said that I really need your help you know, I don't know what to do. And I just remember they asked me a bunch of questions on the phone, all the while knowing that I was taking this huge risk. And at the end, they just said, listen, we can't really offer much help because Iran doesn't recognize dual nationality. And I remember I left that phone call feeling so helpless and hopeless and just not knowing what to do. I felt like I was a source of information for them to write down for their foreign ministries and whatnot, and yet be able to not be able to give anything in return. And you know, part of the Nazanin campaign is to be able to shed light on how this is a behavior repeated by Western governments. That's why I'm so supportive of Richard when he's emphasizing that we need more transparency and access to at least know what they are doing behind the scenes, because that's kind of that's where they say they're doing the most work, right? It's always, please keep quiet. We're doing all that we can. So what are you doing? Because on the surface, it doesn't appear like much.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more, both Anna and Richard, about the campaign, because you've had a tremendous response from the public. And if people are listening and they want to get involved, how can they do so?
Shall I go first and then over to you, Anna? So thank you. I think that's right. We've had a huge amount of care. And obviously we've been going for a long time, but from very early on, when we first started, we had a petition on a website called change.org, which lots of people signed. I remember it after 10 days, it had 500,000 people signed it. Mm-hmm. And the importance of that number, of knowing lots of people cared, of knowing lots of people were following our story, and ultimately for Nazanin's family, and then one day Nazanin to know that there were all these people caring and following and sometimes leaving messages. And, you know, I'm not sure it made it any quicker for her to come home. I'm sure it makes it much quicker for her to recover, to know that there's all these people there. So I think the public keeping us in the light has been profoundly important for feeling cared. And ultimately also for, you know, ultimately in all campaigning, you're trying to get the right people to care enough. And there is a sort of a simplicity to it. If enough people care, the right people care enough is always true. And so we've had lots of support along the way, and we've asked people to do different things, and whether that's, you know, helping with cooking recipes or what they would do if they had one day of freedom or jokes one year. And you know, we're at a point now where it's probably, gosh, I'm not quite sure what we do want people to do, and it probably depends a little bit on what happens in 4 weeks' time, if that makes sense, as to whether we need to have a new move. But the profound importance of people walking alongside us, I don't think it can be understated. Certainly for her, when she came out, out of prison and was at home with her mums and dads, and suddenly could see what was on social media, suddenly could see, I mean, Amnesty had sent a load of cards that people had sent. It was overwhelming. Like, it wasn't, you know, and there's a whole overwhelming aspect of seeing your family album suddenly spread all over newspapers and so on. It's not easy, but actually knowing that you weren't alone, knowing that, you know, your interrogators were watching this stuff, knowing that, that we were being watched, and because we were being watched, we were being protected. I think that's something that the public has given us, and it's made it safer for everyone.
Good. And Anna, you also campaign not just for those held in Iran, but all over the world as well. Tell us a little bit more about that, and again, how people can perhaps become involved should they wish.
Yes, sure. So I just want to add a little story. It was actually thanks to the Free Nazanin campaign that I came forward to speak about my story. I don't know if Richard remembers, but I had refused all interviews and everything, you know, kept far away from the media spotlight for, I think, a total of 3 years post-release. And so, you know, as someone who was in their teens when it all started unraveling, and then I was in my early 20s when I returned to London in 2018, I was just very determined to finish my studies, get on with life, and just pretend that nothing had ever happened, which of course wasn't the case, because I was deeply damaged. My mental health was crippling, and I found it very difficult to trust people. I remember I consistently pushed away everyone that was Iranian, because I was so paranoid that they might be affiliated with the IRGC and they might be following me around in London and whatnot. And so, largely thanks to the Free Nazanin campaign, I decided in July 2019 to, you know, come forward to say, listen, Nazanin is the tip of the iceberg. And it's been with the help and determination of Richard and his family, and of course the huge public support that his campaign has been able to receive, is that we've been able to show to the world how big of a systemic issue this is. I don't think I even heard about Iran taking hostages before Richard. Ignoring the 1979 American hostage crisis. But now, because of this Free Nazanin campaign, we've been able to see that this has actually been happening since the emergence, since the revolution, and since the, you know, the Islamic Republic came to power. And speaking of the public support since I came forward with my story and joined Free Nazanin campaign, I remember we did a Q&A session last year at the, sorry, in 2019, at the London Metropolitan University, where Emmy Howell, a playwright, had directed a play on Nazanin's story. And I remember after the Q&A, I had two young ladies come up to me and say, I can't believe you went through all that when you were the same age as we are now. And, you know, they were so passionate about reading any books that I might want to recommend, or if I would suggest them to write to the foreign secretary. And I just thought that was so humbling, but also so empowering. And yeah, I think at that point I realized that Richard had really uncovered a treasure box of like this immense public support, because I think before then it hadn't appeared to me that people were so interested and wanting to help. Mm. Yeah, sorry, I think I digressed a bit there, but so we did
it's fascinating to hear, Anna, it really is. Keep going.
About hostages worldwide. So I can't take all the credit here, but we did last year, I keep saying last year, but really in 2019. So we co-found the Alliance Against State Hostage Taking with Richard, Nizar Zaka, Shi Wang, Jason Rezaian, and a few other hostage families. One of whom is actually Vida Mehrania, the wife of Dr. Ahmad Reza Jalali, who is a Swedish-Iranian scholar, and he's on death row. So I think Richard and Nizar did the very heavy lifting on this one, but generally we set up an initiative where we are trying to raise awareness of individual cases in countries that so eagerly have found the so-called hostage diplomacy lucrative, and that is of course Iran, China, Russia, Egypt, North Korea, and a few other countries. And so that's the general overview of the alliance. But basically what we try to do is raise awareness of individual cases, bring them up in governmental and intergovernmental institutions so that we can really put them on the forefront of debates and policy discussions. And I think we've been successful so far, especially with Nazanin's case and Anousheh Shoury's case, in raising the matter in the UK Parliament and in the UN, for example.
Great. Fascinating. Thank you, Anna, very much. And sticking on the charity theme, we always give our guests the opportunity to give a shout out to a couple of charities meaningful to them. So Richard, Anna, do you have any charities you'd like to give a particular shout out to?
Go ahead, Richard.
So there are, I mean, I was thinking that there are lots of charities that help us. And there's a way which I prefer to be a bit careful about which ones I pick, which ones I don't. But probably the one who I think is helping us and is small and could definitely do with all the attention and support. There's a torture survivors charity called Redress that is doing quite a lot of work with a number of hostage families, including ours, helping them to do things at the UN, helping them to do things around potential other forms of accountability. Part of which are to get justice, and part of which is also, as Anna was describing, those sort of baby steps to solidarity and to support, and that's almost like a self-help group of us being with each other and supporting each other through. So
that's called Redress, Richard.
Redress.org, I think, is the website.
Great, fantastic. Anna, any for you?
So I'll just highlight two of the biggest charities I think I had an internet disconnection right there, but I'll
That's
continue.
Okay. You're still with us.
So I'll just bring forward two of the. Okay, great. So Hostage UK has been a huge supporter. So Sir mm-hmm. Terry White, I'm sure, as you have also interviewed him for the podcast before.
It's a wonderful character.
Yes, so they have actually really given me newfound hope and shifted my perspective on how I view this ordeal. And the second one is Freedom From Torture, which is also another great charity that offered me really hours of therapy and direction and just helped a lot. So those two, and also NHS. NHS.
Okay. Yep. Yes. They do a fantastic job.
That's a great one. I just have a question as well. So these are all very, heavy cases and there's so many of them happening around the world, and you're not only involved in your own personal experiences, but how, I mean, we all care about those who are at the forefront of the story, but how about yourselves? How do you care for yourselves when you're working on cases day to day and just trying to get the word out? And how would you say, you're looking after yourselves and pushing through other than adrenaline?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think at the beginning for me, it probably was adrenaline and battling and kind of, it's visceral, isn't it? So when we started, both Nazneen and Gabrielle and my, then she wasn't even two, had been taken. So it was kind of crazy. And I just was running around telling the story to whoever would listen. And we were sprinting and obviously, 5 years on, we're not still sprinting. And there was a couple of times where I just sort of crashed. I find now that obviously there's a huge amount of care and support that I rely on, that my other, the rest of my family rely on. So we've done a few things in campaign terms where, like, I did a hunger strike in front of the Iranian embassy almost 2 years ago now. All sorts of people came down and decorated the space. And then lots of Iranians came down and told their stories. And some of their stories were, by and large, not the worst stories. I mean, much worse than ours. Ours was not by any means. And that kind of just feeling like you're not alone and drawing on the emotional concern and strength of the people, talking on podcasts like this, doing interviews, talking with lawyers, talking with other families, plotting what we can do. There's so much to be said for people holding your hand. And I think in the end, that probably is what has got me through it this far.
It's beautiful. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, you've got so much support, Richard. You really have. And hopefully...
Anna, did you want to add? Yeah.
Sorry, Anna. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. I think Richard has more to say on this because he has been like on the go for 5 years now. But to be fair, I'll just add this, which is, I think, again, thanks to Richard. I remember I met Richard for the first time in Waterloo Station. That's kind of where we set up our first meeting. And I came with a heavy chest and like just wanting to pour out all this information because I hadn't been able to discuss it with anyone else in full confidence. And I remember at the end, Richard was just so understanding. And he said, listen, Anna, you can't let this define you. You need to continue your life. And I mean, I still get really emotional when I say that because I just remember, oh my God, I'm gonna cry. But I just remember that it was like such a big moment for me because I realized that this is so true. This was a very traumatic experience, but like life goes on. Ever since, just like that small sentence just made me realize that really I can't let this define me and like I do need to go on, and there are bigger battles to fight. And I think that really gave me fuel to do what I'm doing now, which is just baby steps, but I hope that they count towards something. And if I can help someone in like a tiny little way, I really am doing my part, and I'm happy for it.
Yeah, it may not have defined who you are, but it's definitely shaped shaped what you've become, which is really something special. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, Richard and Anna, thank you both so much for coming on. Richard, I know I speak for so many people that are, you know, hoping and praying that very soon you'll all be back as a family, and you've got tremendous support. And thank you for coming on, speaking so honestly, with such humility. And Anna as well, I know it's still difficult memories for you, but thank you so much for coming on from Sav and I. I really appreciate it. I'm wishing you both all the very, very best. So yeah, thank you so much indeed.
Thank you.
Hi everyone, just a quick postscript to today's episode. Whilst we were talking to Richard and Anna, we have received an email from the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, which Sav's going to read out.
The Foreign Secretary and FCDO remain in close contact with both Mrs. Zaghari Ratcliffe and her family and continue to provide our support. We do not accept Iran detaining dual British nationals as diplomatic leverage. The regime must end its arbitrary detention of all dual British nationals. We continue to do everything we can to secure the release of all dual British nationals so they can be reunited with their loved ones.